I'm Janitara Begum, and I work in Operation Unite, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM WGXC, ACRA.
Wave Farms WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have one you don't need and it's a Macintosh 2019 or newer, please email info@wgxc.org for more information. And thank you for your contribution.
I'm Rob Saffer, host of Overlooked on WGXC. I play overlooked and underplayed music of all kinds. I was born with an old-fashioned transistor radio next to my ear. My parents would come in each night to turn it off, but I'd turn it back on and fall asleep. I burned through a lot of batteries. Fast forward many decades, yes, decades, and I'm still a radio junkie. I can't get enough of it. If I have a spare 3 minutes, I'll throw the station on just to see what's on. My ears are constantly amazed and tingled. And that's why I'm so honored and humbled to be a WGXC programmer. I'm in the company of other great programmers. Take the Magic Stranger Show. The stranger schleps a special turntable to the station just so he can play 78 RPM records on air. And they're not just any 78s. They're usually an amazing array of music that's rare to hear anywhere, especially on the radio. Or the Checkpoint Charlie show with Jeff Economy. He plays great.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show, Good Night Norman, the name of the radio station, WGXC. Radio for open ears, community radio in Hudson, New York, Catskill, New York, and Acre, New York. WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb. But if you're here, you probably know that. It's my stated mission to read fiction. To me, all writing is fiction. If I were to ask you, after having a conversation with you and three others, or four, or one, or however many, if we were all to agree to write what transpired in that conversation, which one would be true? They would all be fiction, even though they would be called non-fiction. But they're fictions. So tonight I'm going to read a piece of non-fiction. Published in The New Yorker on August 27th, 2022. Written by one Nick Romeo. Could be Romeo, I don't know, I never met him. And these words on this page of my laptop do not have a pronunciation guide, nor do they speak aloud. And yet, through the miracle of radio, I will speak them aloud now. The name of the article, How Mondragon Became the World's Largest Co-op. The subheading, In Spain, an industrial-sized conglomerate owned by its workers suggests an alternative future for capitalism. Jorge Vega Hernandez, a mechanical engineer working in northwestern Spain, returned from a business trip and started to feel sick. It was March 2020, the beginning of the pandemic, and so he called a government helpline. He was told that he might have the coronavirus and that he should stay home. But without leaving the house for a test, Hernandez couldn't get proof of his illness. And without that proof, he had no excuse for not coming into work. A week after he got sick, he said his company fired him. The firm cited, quote, insufficient, end quote, job performance as the motive. Alone and newly jobless during lockdown, Hernandez, who was 32 at the time, considered his life. He was an engineer with expertise in the automotive industry, so finding a new position wouldn't be difficult. But he didn't want just any new job. He wanted to work for a company that treated workers decently. His girlfriend, who lived in the Basque region of northern Spain, suggested that he consider a position within a group of worker-owned cooperatives there called Mondragon. The Mondragon Corporation, as it's known, is a voluntary association of 95 autonomous cooperatives that differs radically from a conventional company. Each co-op's highest paid executive makes at most 6 times the salary of its lowest paid employee. There are no outside shareholders. Instead, after a temporary contract, new workers who have proved themselves may become member owners of the co-ops. A managing director acts as a kind of CEO within each co-op, but the members themselves vote on many vital decisions about strategy, salaries, and policy, and the votes of all members, whether they are senior management or blue-collar, count equally. When individual cooperatives do well, their members share in the profits. When times are hard, the cooperatives collectively support one another, sharing funds and reallocating workers among themselves to preserve jobs. During the pandemic, workers at many Mondragon co-ops voted to temporarily reduce their own salaries or hours until markets recovered. People who felt sick were trusted and encouraged to stay home. The treatment Hernandez said he received when he was fired would be almost impossible within Mondragon, since worker owners must vote to dismiss one another, and this can occur only in cases of very severe misconduct. Worker-owned cooperatives are often considered both idealistic and inefficient. The model is seen as suitable mainly for upscale grocery stores or boutique bakeries in progressive towns. At a 2019 conference, the economist Larry Summers characterized co-ops as intrinsically sleepy and short-sighted. When you put workers in charge of firms and you give them substantial control over the firms, he said, the one thing you do not get is expansion. You get more for the people who are already there. And yet, Mondragon is not a sleepy grocery store. Its collection of co-ops employs around 80,000 people, and 76% of those who work in manufacturing co-ops are owners. One makes bicycles at an industrial scale. Others make elevators or produce huge industrial machines used in the production of jet engines, rockets, and wind turbines. Mondragon's businesses include schools, a large grocery chain, a catering company, 14 technology R&D centers, and a McKinsey-like consulting firm. In 2021, the network brought in more than 11 billion euros in revenue. The collective enforces 505 types of patents and employs about 2,400 full-time researchers. It also owns subsidiaries in countries including China, Germany, and Mexico, and competes effectively in international markets, winning contracts from firms such as General Electric and Blue Origin. The odds are good that key elements of something within 100 feet of you, an espresso maker, a gas grill, a car, were made by Mondragon. We are kind of a mirror for conventional companies, and in it, they do not see a very beautiful image. Under Exeberia, Mondragon's director of cooperative dissemination told me as we drove between co-ops in the Basque country. A slender, affable man who speaks many languages, Exeberia is essentially a professional explainer of Mondragon to its roughly 2,000 annual visitors. It was a warm spring afternoon, and he rolled down the windows and gestured to the passing countryside as we drove. A flock of sheep clustered on a hillside above the squat, above the squat rectangular headquarters of a precision machine tooling co-op. We passed a bank, a language instruction school, a grocery store, a factory, each owned by its workers. Mondragon's network of co-ops, many clustered along Spain's Deba River, has managed to survive nearly 70 years of capitalism's creative destruction. Its persistence suggests that there are fairer and more sustainable ways of doing business. But whether a version of its model could be replicated outside of one beautiful region of northern Spain is an open question, debated within Mondragon and beyond. The collective has a unique history, and its density powers a rare feedback loop in which cooperative values shape institutions, which then reinforce the same values, spiraling outward to define an entire way of life. Mondragon is an inspiring and successful experiment. Will it ever be repeated? The town of Mondragon, in a green river valley surrounded by the Cantabrian mountains, is home to some 22,000 people. A medieval city occupies the town center, with stone archways that soar over cobbled streets and a medieval Gothic church in a central square. The remains of José María Arizmendiarreta, the Catholic priest who founded the Mondragon cooperatives, are buried inside. Born in 1915, Arizmendiarreta lost an eye in a childhood accident. Mobilized during the Spanish Civil War, but unable to take part in the fighting, he still served as a Basque language journalist for a publication opposed to the nationalists led by Franco. He was arrested by Franco's forces and spent a month in prison before being released. After the war, he became a priest and was assigned by the church to the town of Mondragon in 1941 when he was 25. He found that the area's economy was deeply impoverished with virtually no middle class and that its society had been fractured by the Civil War. He mobilized citizens to launch civic and cultural initiatives, including a soccer field, a medical clinic, and a housing complex for workers. Since the early 20th century, a locksmithing factory in Mondragon had been employing local boys who sometimes started at the age of 14, clocked 50-hour weeks, and had few prospects without further education. Upon arrival, Arizmendiarreta began using the local Catholic Action Center to educate young workers through study circles, which met in a converted 17th-century palace. In 1943, Arizmendiarreta created a technical school. Students there worked at the factory in the morning and attended classes in the afternoon. Eventually, he selected a group of promising workers who in the evenings began pursuing long-distance degrees in engineering. By 1956, five members who had finished their degrees left their factory jobs to launch a cooperative company that produced kerosene heaters. More industrial co-ops began appearing throughout the valley, drawing workers from the technical school and collaborating with one another to share expertise. Thus was born the Mondragon experiment. The growth of the co-ops followed a pattern. An obstacle would confront local workers, and a new co-op would be created to overcome it. When in 1958, the Spanish Ministry of Labor excluded the new worker owners from the National Social Security System, arguing that they were not eligible for workers' benefits because they were also part owners, Arizmendi Arrieta created an internal pension and healthcare system that was itself organized as a cooperative. It still exists today, supplying sick leave, parental leave, a generous pension, unemployment benefits, and medical insurance to Mondragon's worker owners. The Spanish government has since revised its position and provides coverage for co-op members in addition to that offered by Mondragon. To meet the need for affordable financing, Arizmendi Arrieta organized a cooperative bank. On my first afternoon in Mondragon, Exeberia and I walked into the dark interior of the church beside the central square. I could hear a choir rehearsing a hymn. Exeberia pointed to the tomb of Arizmendi Arrieta on one side of the central aisle. A stack of pamphlets lay beside it, and I took one. It was part of a campaign to canonize the priest, whom it described as the, quote, apostle of cooperation, end quote. I stood for a while, absorbing the atmosphere. The Mondragon Corporation has no official position on the canonization campaign, but Arizmendi Arrieta is venerated among the secular. I saw that the pamphlet included a suggested prayer to Arizmendi Arrieta and information on whom to contact if it were answered. I walked back out into the sun. There are earthquakes, tsunamis, tornadoes, and there is Arizmendi Arrieta, Exeberia told me in the square. We are lucky he struck here. Hernandez was hired by a Mondragon co-op called Soraluce in 2021 and now hopes to work there permanently at the end of his 2-year temporary contract. Located in a nearby town, the co-op occupies a boxy facility roughly the size of 5 football fields and employs 265 people in the Basque Country to design and manufacture large milling and boring machines used to help produce wind turbines, boat engines, and components for airplanes and spaceships. Futuristic equipment looms over the factory floor, with workers buzzing around making adjustments. On a drizzly spring morning, 9 members of Soraluce's social council, an elected group that facilitates information sharing between managers and workers, gathered in a brightly lit conference room for their monthly meeting with Soraluce's president and Rafael Idigoras, the co-op's managing director. The men and women were casually dressed. Most were drinking espresso from paper cups. Idigoras projected his laptop onto a screen and embarked on a brisk presentation in Spanish about Soraluce's strategy. First, he showed a pie chart of 2021 sales by country around the world. Then he offered details on a new manufacturing facility that was soon to be built at a cost of 8 million euros. As an industrial rumble suffused the room from below, he went over the co-op's 40 million euro investment in R&D over the past decade. A man interrupted by standing up then announced that he just received an email confirming the sale of a 1.8 million euro machine to a company in Germany. Applause broke out around the table. "What are you still doing here?" someone joked. "Go sell another." Fred Freundlich, a professor of organization and cooperative enterprise at Mondragon University, a co-op descendant of the original technical school, which offers bachelor's and graduate degrees to many of Mondragon's future workers, told me that visitors are often surprised by how much information the cooperatives share internally. Conventional companies regularly brief investors and shareholders on earnings, strategy, and the health of the business. Mondragon's co-ops share the same detailed information with worker owners, who buy into their co-ops by making one-time payments of roughly 16,000 euros in most co-ops. Funds from the buy-ins are stored in individual accounts, which can earn interest up to 7.5% a year. If a co-op goes out of business, a rare occurrence, the funds disappear, but in good years, a portion of its dividends is added to the balance. At Soroluce, Idigoras told me, typical worker owners have about a quarter of a million euros in their accounts by the time they retire, often at age 62. A co-op's general assembly, comprising all of its members, elects a governing council, which then appoints a managing director. The system is vulnerable to the habits of its voters. Although 42% of Mondragon owners are female, only 29% of governing council members are women. Still, the fact remains that Idigoras, the managing director, works for Soroluce's members rather than the reverse. It's as if Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, had been chosen by a committee elected by a broad sampling of the bank's workforce, receptionists, cashiers, cleaners, investment analysts. If J.P. Morgan adopted Mondragon's 6-to-1 pay ratio, Dimon's compensation would be capped at 6 times that of his lowest paid employee. While it's hard to estimate his hypothetical salary too narrowly, he would almost certainly make less than $1 million instead of the more than $84 million he earned in 2021. And his decisions would be subject to approval by workers. Furthermore, if J.P. Morgan were a Mondragon co-op, its profits and staff would sometimes be shared with Bosque co-op versions of Bank of America and Wells Fargo. It's easy to assume that such arrangements must impair productivity, but multiple academic studies have found that cooperatives with worker governance and ownership are as profitable as or more profitable than ordinary firms. Researchers note that in co-ops, incentives are better aligned. People benefit directly when the co-op succeeds, and so they are more committed. The same principle motivates work at many startups. They also find that democratic governance empowers workers to suggest improvements and increases their satisfaction. Certainly, many people seem to stay at Mondragon because they enjoy working there. "If I worked outside of Mondragon, I'd earn more money," Ion Belza, an engineer and industrial director at Fagor Automation, told me. "But I prefer to live here with a lot of people and friends than alone like a king." Much of the social life in the town of Mondragon happens in culinary clubs. Hybrids between clubs and restaurants that are managed cooperatively, with logistics handled by rotating committees. New members can join a culinary club only after their applications have been approved in a vote. Membership fees are around 20 euros a month. It would, if you belong to a culinary club, you simply reserve the facilities, show up with friends and food, and enjoy full use of a fancy, well-stocked professional kitchen and bar. Members are trusted to record whatever they use, and accounts are settled monthly. On a warm weekday evening, I had dinner at a culinary club on the second floor of a building in the old town. The interior of the club felt vaguely medieval, with dark wood panels, exposed stone walls, and a mellow glow from recessed lights. Belza, the engineer from Fagor Automation, was grilling T-bone steaks on the industrial range as a small group chatted in the dining room, eating tiksora, a local sausage, from gleaming silver trays. Exeberia, wearing a yellow hoodie and sipping a glass of local red wine, was recalling an old legend about a dragon that had once terrorized the people of Mondragon. "He came down from his cave in the mountains to eat people," Exeberia said of the dragon. "The villagers told him, if you only come once a year, we will give you the most beautiful young woman in town. But this was not a good solution, so they tricked him. They made a woman out of wax, and when he began to eat it, it melted in his mouth. Then all the iron workers rushed forward together and killed him with their tools." He paused for dramatic effect before intoning the lesson. "In other towns, they hired St. George to kill the dragons. But in Mondragon, we killed him cooperatively." The story provoked a burst of laughter and commentary. "Come on," said a photographer in a black leather jacket whose family owned a local non-cooperative company that manufactures keys. As an allegory for the Mondragon cooperatives, the myth is irresistible. The poverty of post-Civil War Spain, the oppression of the Franco dictatorship, the 2008 crash, the pandemic, the co-ops have subdued many menacing dragons through collective action. But the model also has its limits. To some critics, Mondragon's overseas workers who are not owners, it outsources to low-cost locations operating 132 production plants in 32 countries, are a sacrifice to the dragon of capitalism. Noam Chomsky has made many admiring remarks about Mondragon, but has also argued that the cooperatives, quote, still exploit workers in South America, and they do things that are harmful to society as a whole, end quote. In a system in which businesses must make a profit in order to survive, Chomsky added, quote, they have no choice. Members of Mondragon's management defend these overseas plants, which are often located close to the assembly sites of its large customers. One executive with experience in running these plants noted that profit sharing presupposes profit, and that worker ownership requires a successful business for workers to own. If Mondragon were to situate its factories only in Spain, he told me, the collective would be unable to compete globally, forcing it to reduce its homegrown workforce. He also pointed out that in Mexico, Mondragon has studied the possibility of organizing some of its factories into cooperatives, but didn't go through with it. The Mondragon executive cited a lack of co-op-friendly laws in the country, as well as insufficient interest among workers. Similar studies in other countries did not lead to the creation of foreign Mondragon co-ops. Not everyone has found these arguments persuasive. Freundlich, the professor at Mondragon University, told me, there are worker-owned companies who have figured out how to share ownership with their subsidiaries overseas. If they can do it, we should be able to do it. Over dessert at the culinary club, I mentioned a refrain I'd heard throughout my visit. Many people had told me that the original spirit of cooperation was declining. The rise of overseas subsidiaries was one sign of this decline. So was the gradual widening of the pay ratio between top executives and lowest paid workers. Originally, it was 3-1. In 1972, it became 4.5-1. since the late 80s, it's been 6-1. Perhaps the true dragon was a slow decay of the cooperative ethos. Javier Ormaiteca, a dark-haired 27-year-old engineer at a co-op, was the youngest person at the table and the grandson of one of Mondragon's original five founders, who worked alongside Arismendi Arrieta, the priest. He nodded agreement and offered a dictum. Hard times make strong people. Strong people make good times. And good times make weak people, he said. He meant that the co-op spirit had been stronger in the mid-20th century when Spain was haunted by the specters of Franco and war. Around the table, there were murmurs of assent. Ormaiteca described a recent controversy within the Fagor group of cooperatives. Engineers and managers had proposed raises for themselves that would help bring their salaries closer to market rates. The salaries would not exceed the 6-1 ratio, but would be near the top end of the range, creating a larger internal pay gap. Upset by the proposal, some workers near the bottom of the pay scale at Fagor, one of the group's co-ops, convened an extraordinary general assembly at which members discussed and voted on the proposal. In the end, it passed by a wide margin. If we're going to compete, it'll go up, Ormaiteca predicted of the 6-1 ratio. I don't know when and I don't know how much, but it will. Mondragon's salary ratio cap, he continued, reminded him of a popular Basque soccer club, Athletic Bilbao, which plays in Spain's top division and uses a local origin rule, only hiring players born or trained in the Basque country. A noble bit of idealism that some say limits the club's ability to compete at the highest level. They can do pretty well, but they can't compete with the best who pay for the most talented players in the world, he said. Hey, they can still win, the photographer, a fan of the Basque soccer team, objected. Then he added, even if they don't, it's better to keep local players. The people inside Mondragon. Even minor changes can seem to signal a catastrophic decline in values. But to outsiders, the collective remains a baffling business from another dimension. Inigo Usin, the president of Mondragon, told me that American and Chinese visitors often confuse its model with a form of communism. Usin recalled one American business person who asked how Arismendi Arrieta could be a real priest if he was a communist. Another struggled to understand why one would start a co-op if it didn't enjoy special tax advantages. Tax law in the Basque country treats cooperatives and conventional companies differently, but their total obligations are similar. American executives can seem less curious about how co-ops work than about what kind of car Usin drives, a BMW 3 Series. The culture shock is mutual. Usin told me that he couldn't believe how much well-paid American executives were willing to reduce the wages of their comparatively underpaid employees. America's current economic arrangements, he argued, are completely unsustainable. How many poor people there are in the United States is unbelievable, he said. Something's clear. In the future, things have to change. At the same time, it wouldn't be easy for the Mondragon model to succeed in a country like America, Eugene thought. You can't have cooperatives without cooperative people, he said. On my last night in Spain, I met Alberto Goranyogueta. My Basque is a little challenged, sorry. Son of one of the original five founders and a vice president at Mondragon. He walked me through the old town's narrow streets, pausing to point out the house where he'd been born, the location of the Young Catholic Action Center where youth people had gathered into study circles. I think that probably should say young people, and an apartment where Arizmendiarrieta had lived. At a bar near a towering stone archway, we found a table outside. It was early evening. The light was soft, and the whole town seemed to be out socializing. Kids rode past on scooters. Teens cruised in small packs, and adults clustered around tables at cafes and bars. Every few minutes, someone walking past would stop to chat with Goronyo Gyota. He, too, worried that cooperative values in Mondragon were declining. We have to keep something different inside of us, something more just, more humane, if we want this model of business to continue, he said, frowning. I mentioned my own country, America, and he seemed to cheer up. The U.S. was a reminder that things could be worse. Compared to practices at places like Amazon or Uber, Mondragon seems like a shocking success. When I asked Ormai Teixeira if he thought Mondragon's 6-to-1 pay ratio would ever explode to match America's, a study by the Economic Policy Institute on America's largest companies found that in 2020, the compensation rate between CEOs and typical workers was 351-to-1. He was doubtful. That couldn't happen here, he said. They'd vote against it. Our conversation turned to the many recent declarations of support for corporate social responsibility by major American and European companies. Goronyo Gyota was very skeptical of such statements, which he saw more as a matter of marketing than genuine commitment. Corporate social responsibility is all too often lies, he said, and took a sip of beer. Goronyo Gyota looked into the distance and reminisced. Arizmendiarrieta died of complications from heart disease in 1976 at the age of 61. Goronyo Gyota recalled how his father, along with the other founders, had felt orphaned. He gestured at everything surrounding us. They couldn't have imagined that if it would grow into all this. He recalled his father telling him about a senior religious functionary from the Vatican who'd once visited Mondragon to collect evidence of miracles for Arizmendiarrieta's possible canonization. As he left, the visitor made a half-joking comment that Goronyo Gyota thought struck home. Even setting aside the supernatural, Mondragon's cooperatives look like a kind of miracle. If that's true, they're a miracle of an unusual kind, one that actually exists and could be repeated. That's the New Yorker article written by Nick Romeo, who teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley and is the author of The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. That was 2 years ago, that he, 2.5 years ago that he worked there. I don't know if he still does. Nick Romeo, like Juliet, telling lies, fictions. I mean, I know all you libtards out there and all you maggots, you all think this is impossible in the United States, but I've been looking into it. Tax laws for worker-owned cooperatives are favorable to those for shareholder-type corporations, although there are employee-owned corporations that sell shares, but only employees can buy shares. And shareholders, no matter how many they have, only have one vote. A company that you may or may not heard of that has this kind of employee stock option corporation is Bob's Red Mill. Those people, they sell flour and oatmeal and grains and stuff. 5,000 employees. Was a privately owned company, and before the founder, Bob, died, he wanted to keep the company going, and he appreciated the people who had helped him build it, that being the employees, and so turned it into an employee stock-owned company. There are many other worker cooperatives in the United States, but I'm not going to list them. I'm going to plug myself. I'm trying to do this. I want to do a project based on this article. So get in touch with me if you're interested. It's, 1241 Monday morning. The third day of March, 2025th year of the Jesus era. I guess it's not the Jesus era. It's more like the Christian era. I always forget, like a lot of people, that Jesus was not a Christian. Or I should say Christ was not a Christian, shouldn't I? Anyways, I suppose I should read some more fiction before I start yelling at people for, like, weirdly posting things about Trump constantly on social media. It's so stupid and annoying. Like, just calling him names, like, what are you doing? Like, think of something constructive like these people did. Like, do something. Like, it's like you want, like, a good cop. Like, you're like, oh, I actually saw someone who said they missed Joe Biden. I was like, what? And for those who don't remember, Ronald Reagan fired 15,000 air traffic controllers as soon as he went into office. Then he slashed the education budget and said for school lunches, which were part of what he cut, ketchup was a vegetable. This is true. This all happened before. Trump isn't the first scumbag president of the United States. Then Bill Clinton signed derivatives, which made everybody get crazy rich for no reason. Then Obama bailed out all the banks. Before them, you had Richard Nixon. You think that guy was a good guy? He got actually impeached and resigned. And not for slaughtering thousands of civilians and millions of civilians in other countries far away. On the news every day. Anyways, I know you guys think you're like undergoing something new, but you're not. But don't take it from me. I'm just the fiction guy. I'm making all this up. None of this is actually happening. None of that happened before either. But you know what? I will plug a product. If you can find a copy of Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States, have a look at that. It's 12 hours long. I'm sorry. But I know you binge on whatever else you're binging on out there for 12 hours. You can do it. You don't have to read anything. It has, like, pictures, moving pictures. There's a guy with a voiceover explaining them, which would be Oliver Stone. There's sound bites of other people. It's like real TV by a noted director, Oliver Stone. Anyways, it's like historical footage and all that kind of stuff. It has science in it. There's like science, like Oppenheimer making the atom bomb and going, oops, that's in there. There's Democrats railroading Harry Walker out of the presidential run in favor of the shop owner Truman. Kind of reminiscent of recent behaviors of the Democrats, with a guy from Vermont whose name will remain nameless, pitted against some capitalist Maggie Thatcher in disguise. Anyways, yeah. I don't usually do this, so I'm just going to do it because I'm really tired of people like acting like these leaders are supposed to do something for you. Like, You're just following them. Like saying, like posting about Trump every day, whether you love him or hate him, it's the same thing. It's like Adolf Hitler said, I don't care what they say about me as long as they spell my name right. And like, you're not spelling the guy's name right, okay? I get that. You know, you're afraid that you're going to be censored on Facebook or Instagram or something because so you come up with clever names. They're not clever. You're not clever. You're just regurgitating what mainstream corporate advertiser sponsored media is allowing you to see. But you're not coming up with any alternative other than to protest for or against him. It's the same. It does nothing. When there's a civil war, do you think any of these guys are going to be near the front lines? No. They're going to be far away selling weapons to both sides. As Jay Gould said, American capitalists back in the 19th century, that would be the 1800s for those of you who don't understand numbers. As Jay Gould, Robert Barron, American capitalist said, I can pay one half the working class to kill the other half. Nothing has changed. Wake up. Get it together. I mean, I'm not one to speak, you know. It's hard to start a cooperative when nobody wants to start a cooperative. I'll get more pushback from libtards than right-wingers about it. Oh, that'll never work. That's what they always say about health care. Democrats, they have health care for one term. They abandon it. Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the White House. Did Clinton or Obama put them back or Biden? No. It was a simple gesture. Reagan didn't have to ask permission from Congress. He just took them off. Carter didn't ask permission from Congress. He just put them up. And then after that, everybody forgot about it, just like health care. Biden forgot about it. The Democrats forgot about it. Health care, what's that? Oh, you mean Luigi? Nobody voted for him until he started talking the way Americans like to talk, with guns that were sold to him by some rich guys. Or were they? Well, the parts were, I guess. I don't know. I feel like I can talk lies for a little while. Because I always read fiction, you know, and I always bite my tongue. And nobody really listens anyways to this radio show. And this will help you go to sleep, too, just listening to me rant and rave. But yeah, I looked it up. Worker cooperatives do exist in the United States. You could form one with five people like this guy did in the Bosque, or 50 people, or 5,000 people like Bob did with his Red Mill. You could do it. You could advocate for something besides a good cop. We need a good leader. You don't need a good leader. You need to be a good person. But I don't know. I don't own a corporation. I don't own anything. I can barely cooperate with the mothers of my kids or my best friends. So don't listen to me. I'm not asking you to follow me. I'm not trying to make you be my leader. I'm just saying cooperate with each other. Figure it out. That's not the point of me saying what I'm saying, is to read what I'm reading, is to be your leader. I don't want to be your leader or your favorite story reader. I'm just doing what I'm doing. But what I'm doing, I mean, I guess it is a reaction to what everybody else is reacting to, but it's kind of a reaction that I've had for like 50 years, you know? It's not a reaction that I just got awakened to like 2 months ago or 8 years ago or anything like that. There's like Richard Nixon, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Democrat and Republican, John F. Kennedy, Vietnam, that's all. It's enough. I don't know why people, and then you had the same thing. People protesting in the streets and on college campuses mainly. But you had the silent majority. You had all these people. That's what they were called. They weren't called MAGA then. They were the silent majority. They voted for Nixon. Boom. Two times. Landslide. Wang. Why not? Why did they vote for Nixon? Because the ultra-left didn't like the Democrats then, because they saw who the Democrats were. They were a bunch of butchers, too. And then all the mainstream middle-class Democrats, they're all like, oh, gee, jeepers, I'm going to ride my friggin' horsey. Why are those kids so mad that they don't vote for the butcher, Richard Daley and Lyndon Johnson? And they didn't vote, and they let the butcher, Richard Nixon, they're all butchers. It's like, wake up. Every last one, even Carter, they forced him to be a butcher in his last year. They were like, come on. Over there torturing people in Iran. He was like, okay. He tried to keep it low-key and small. Nope. He got caught. And then everybody got mad at him, and then they hired the next butcher, Ronald Reagan, who didn't have any major wars going on, but he had plenty of military buildup happening and lots of little dictatorships and overthrows going on in Central and South America while he was in there. Nothing happening at home that people noticed. I mean, except for Afghanistan got started back then, which went on way past when Obama said it wasn't going to go on. It's all the same. They're all the same. Military-industrial complex. Everybody knows that. Dwight D. Eisenhower said it, even though he was it. So he should know, right? Takes one to know one. Make it cooperative. Get it together. Stop looking at the news. Start writing some manifestos and some bylaws. A federal credit union can be started by people. You could even issue banknotes. Look up Silvio Gisell, money that depreciates, stamp script currency, almost adopted by FDR during the Depression to alleviate inflation, but voted down by guess who? The bankers. It was successful in Austria until another little Austrian moved in there. Little henchmen of Disney and Ford. And Bush. Man, people need to get it together. You really do. Just go find out. Go pay attention. Don't listen to me. Really, I'm not the leader. I'm telling you. You don't need a leader. You just need to, like, get together with some people and do it. There's like whole countries that have worker caps on CEOs. Norway, it's 35. Where I lived and worked for a year. 35 times the lowest paid worker is the cap on CEO salaries in Norway. They exist in other countries too. They're different. They're not the same. It's not only a Mondragon worker co-op idea. But, I don't know. You really gotta, like, have some people that are really committed to, like, actually figuring out some ideas that already exist, just, like, trying to apply them. Even Occupy, they didn't really have any plan. They were just like, we don't want good cops. You all want good cops. You want cancellation cops. Cops. I don't, you know, there shouldn't be any genders on any bedroom, any bathrooms. There shouldn't be marriage at all, as far as I'm concerned. If I was your benevolent dictator, I would say no gay marriage, no straight marriage, no marriage, period. Live in co-ops, live in communes. It takes a village. Get one. Raise those kids together. Forget about school. I would close the public schools. They suck. Stay home and educate your kids. Grow some food. Help each other build your houses. Get it together, people. Wake the fuck up. You're fighting for crumbs. With the people that work right next to you all the time. Going down the street, all those people in cars are workers. Go to the store, those people are workers. Everything that you're buying is made by workers. They're all people just like you. They don't really know politics because you don't know politics, because nobody's practicing it. You don't know what you aren't practicing or researching. You're just watching the news. That's not politics. That's propaganda. It's what sells. The advertisers love it. Who are the advertisers? The corporations. Nobody's giving you facts in the news. They're giving you opinions. It's all opinions. In Europe, you have parties. You have a multi-party system. So you have a communist paper. You have a fascist paper. You have a Green Party paper. You have a socialist paper. You have a Christian Democrat paper. You have all these papers. You read all these papers, and then maybe you'll get some idea of what's going on if you read them all. But none of them are telling you the truth. They're giving you a party line. New York Times is a party line. CNN is a party line. Fox, it's a party line. It's all a party line. I know reporters. They're trying to do a party line. There's one from the Times, comes around here now, talks to me. They got a party line they want to push about black people being victims. I'm like, well, I can't really help you with that. I'm not here to make more victims. That's a party line, the victim. Everybody's adopted it. White guys adopted it. Black guys adopted it, white women, black women, queers of all kinds. I'm a victim. How about that rich lady over at Foreland? Because her partner is a female, I'm not supposed to say anything bad about her. The fact that her parents are like owners of a major hotel chain and she's over there talking about what a victim she is. Because she threw out the housing coalition. She's the victim. You better stop victimizing yourselves. All right. It's almost over. WGXC is a community radio station. The views and opinions expressed by your host are entirely his and fictional. Go read a book. Don't blame me for telling you lies. My show is all about fictions. Tune in next time. What's the date? I mean, it's really confusing, this midnight thing. The actual date of the next show will be the 17th. But it will seem more like the 16th at midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley Radio, community radio for open ears, WGXC.org on the World Wide Interweb. As Edward R. Murrow used to say, good night and good luck. I'm your host, Norman Douglas. Good night, Norman.